The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by comedian, actor, and director Rami Youssef. He's the creator and star of the titular Emmy-nominated series, Rami. If you haven't seen the show, it's based on Rami's experiences as a first-generation Egyptian-American Muslim on a spiritual journey through a politically divided New Jersey neighborhood. I should also add, in case it wasn't clear by my overly serious description, the show is really, really funny. You'll hear why in this conversation that I had with Rami, which covers the Israel-Palestine episode in season 3, his Jersey upbringing and early forays into film, the politics of his stand-up comedy, and how, as a first-generation Egyptian-American, he's redefining what the American dream looks like. I should also note at the top that we taped this talk a little before the writer's strike began on May 2nd. We do allude to the strike in passing, but since the WGA went on the offensive, many of its members, of which Rami is one, have suspended all press appearances out of solidarity. Later this summer, we will be doing an episode on the strike and all that's at stake as writers fight for a fair, equitable deal with the AMPTP, which includes places like Netflix, Amazon, Disney, and just about every other major studio in town. But until then, if you'd like to learn more about the working conditions that writers like Rami are fighting for, we've included resources in our show notes at talkeasypod.com. As for today, I want to recommend season 3 of Rami. It's now available to stream on Hulu. It's one of my favorite shows of the last couple years, and it was an absolute joy and thrill to sit with the one and only Rami Youssef. Rami Youssef.
Yeah.
A pleasure to meet you.
So good to meet you.
How are you feeling?
I'm really happy to be here. A lot of stuff happened already off pod. There's a lot of good snacks outside and great coffee. Do you have any idea how many things I go to that are completely snackless? There's just not a single offering of anything. Maybe water, and you can tell it's tap. But here, I mean, this shit is filtered. Thank you.
Is this material for your new stand-up special?
I express myself in sometimes things that sound like they could be bits, but I'm not a tester. I don't test my material in conversation. If I think something's a bit, I keep it to myself. I'll try it on stage.
Because you don't want to give ideas away for free.
It feels cheap. It feels like I'm using a lunch to further my career when I'm just trying to have lunch with my friend.
Well, you're on a podcast, so if you want to try stuff out, you're more than welcome to.
This is a gray area. But I will say it falls a bit into the lunch category because of the snack quality that you offered.
Do Pop-Tarts constitute a lunch for you?
So there's this bag here of mini Pop-Tarts that is blowing my mind because I never want to commit to a whole Pop-Tart.
Of course.
And I feel bad that they figured out the product outside of my prime of eating it.
32 past Pop-Tart prime.
32 years old. It starts to get weird.
You know what's unbelievable? People always say about our show that we really talk about these big, weighty subjects, but really, we can talk Pop-Tarts.
Get me going on Gushers, and it'll get deep.
I am kind of afraid to get you going on Gushers. I feel like we'll never get anywhere. I do want to start with something that's just happened, though.
Yeah.
You recently observed Ramadan, right?
Yeah, it's been a week.
I wanted to start here because you've said this holiday, more than birthdays, has always been a marker of time for me.
Mm.
What did this marker denote this year around?
Great question. You know, this year I was traveling a lot. So I spent some of it in the Middle East. I was in Saudi and I was in Egypt. And then I also was in Chicago. So it was cool to be in three different places. And one of my favorite things is no matter where you are during Ramadan, there's night prayers going on. So you can just go to a mosque almost anywhere. And there's people there doing the same exact thing, breaking fast at the same exact time. So it's incredibly grounding, you know, and especially as someone who travels a bunch for stand-up or for whatever, filming stuff, you show up to a new city and you feel a little weird at first. And so to kind of travel that way where knowing no matter where I was going to be, there was going to be something I was going to be doing every single night was really cool. And it felt this year on paper should have been harder than other years. You know, a lot of times I like to stay in the same place because you're not eating or drinking from sunrise to sunset. But it didn't present itself that way, which was really cool. It didn't feel difficult.
What were the takeaways, if there were any, from this reflection?
For me, coming to LA right now, and I spent so many of my 20s here, and it was really emotionally turbulent. And, you know, it's just like anyone's 20s. You're trying to figure out who you are. And so there were times where I would just feel all over the place. And I think this year was probably the first year that I thought, oh, wow, I'm feeling less scattered. I'm not letting as many things get under my skin as I would have this time last year. And I think sometimes the threshold is really low when you're not eating and you don't have coffee and you don't have water. You see how quickly you can get frustrated. And it really shows you where you're at. You feel really naked. No caffeine will really show you where you are. And I was like, okay, I haven't had my coffee and I'm still good.
You mentioned last year. Why don't we talk about some of what happened? Because you released season 3 of this show, mm-hmm. Rami. And since the show came out, I believe in September of 2022, the tensions between Israel and Palestine, they have only escalated.
Mm.
Having filmed in Jerusalem, how are you thinking about both the conflict over there, but also the context that people now have in approaching something like episode 2 of season 3?
Yeah, well, you know, it was end of September was the third season of Rami. And then in August, we released the first season of Mo, where he's, you know, proudly an undocumented Palestinian guy in Texas. And then in Rami, we have a totally different take where Rami is, you know, American born. And the episode we did is almost completely around his own privilege as being kind of American born and going over. So what's been a culture shift when I think about when we started writing both those projects, it felt risky at the time to even, you know, and this was before there was like what I would call a big kind of viral Instagram moment, that the summer of 2021, when people really started talking about what was happening with the occupation of Sheikh Jarrah, and also even people really being open and saying, you know, this isn't a conflict, this is an occupation. You know, this is a completely inhumane thing that is happening. And I think even in the time, like you're pointing out, from writing the projects to releasing the projects, big change. Because by the time they came out, it was like, oh, wow, people were more open to having this conversation. It doesn't feel as whoa as when we wrote it, right? And that's in an American context, because I think in Europe and throughout other parts of the world, people understand what's happening in a more clear way. And so I think the approach that we've taken with both shows, to me, was always kind of a timeless approach, because we're focusing on character. So we're not getting into the nitty-gritty of political debate as much as we are kind of saying, you know, what is the, you know, blind eye that an American Muslim like Rami turns to when, you know, he's living in a country that also has colonial tendencies, and then he's visiting a country that is being affected by colonialism. And so watching that all play out, again, from a personal place, right? Like, I'm not trying to use the show to sit and go back and forth. There's people who are way more qualified than me to talk about this, but we're trying to just put human characters in the middle of it.
Well, why don't we take a look at a scene from that episode where your character is in Jerusalem on a kind of Tinder-like date.
Yeah.
This is from season 3, episode 2 of Rami, now available on Hulu.
I can't believe you actually came.
Yeah, sorry, I was late. The fucking checkpoint took forever.
Yeah, with checkpoints, times are never accurate.
No, I know. It's so frustrating. Like, I'm from New Jersey. And we have, if you heard the Lincoln Tunnel, it's basically a fucking checkpoint. Like, it takes hours to get into New York, but sometimes it takes minutes, so everyone's always just confused. Like, and is it gonna take a long time? Is it not? And then it costs like $20 now to get in. At least you guys, you don't have to pay, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. We don't need to keep talking about this. Shubtishtol.
I work in jewelry. It's why I came. What about you?
I work in a restaurant in Ramallah, but I'm starting my lingerie company.
Really?
Yeah, super affordable lingerie, and the tag is everyone has the right to be sexy.
Wow, your family's is okay with that? Like, religiously?
Muslims in the West are so fucking uptight. You act like no one ever kissed before. It's lingerie. Everyone wears it. Umma kaman tilbasum.
Yeah, of course. I'm not uptight. Like, I've kissed before.
My favorite part is him complaining about the commute, like it's going from Santa Monica to Los Feliz. It's like, it's east. I know, stuff happened.
Yeah, she's like, they built the wall that wasn't there before. And he's like, I get it, stuff happened. But, you know, you really could have told me before I got in.
Yeah,
you know, you
could have told me there was an accident on the 101.
So, you know, that's really where, you know, we talk about a character with privilege and a character who is clearly, you know, we get into his addict-like tendencies. And I think it says everything, too, though, about the perception, right? She starts talking about lingerie and he's like, what? You guys are that open about, you know, and not realizing that the American Muslim bubble is really that. It's a bubble and it's oddly disconnected at times from what's actually happening in the Middle East, because you have all these kids who are, you know, their parents were immigrants and haven't been back for a while. And they're really working hard to maintain the image they have of where they were. But it's from like the 80s. It's missing the last 40 years. And we grew up with it. And then you kind of go over and you realize, whoa, they're moving at a really different pace than what we've been trying to uphold.
There's not a whole lot in the middle of the Israel-Palestine Venn diagram. Did you create Rami in that scene so that they could both agree on something, which is that, you know, you're not a great guy?
The design of the episode from the writer's room was purely Rami's going to sit with the Palestinian woman, he's going to sit with an Israeli woman, and in both situations, he's going to be like, what the fuck's going on with this guy? You know, that was 100% straight up character assassination on a level. It felt like the only way, again, to keep it, you know, to keep it character. But this woman that he goes on this field date with, I think the actress herself, I think, got the script and said, whoa, I could say this, you know, and that's what's fun about making something with a crew in the actual place. I mean, you know, here you're on set, only producers or writers talk over there. The guy, you know, who's doing craft service and bringing food will say, hey, man, you know, it would be better if you said in this part. And, you know, and he'll say that to me, you know, between takes. And I'll go, oh, okay, yeah, that, yeah, you live here. I'll take the note. You know, I'll take notes from anybody, you know, the transpo guy, whoever, whoever's got a thought. And same thing, you know, we obviously had a Palestinian director on the episode, but being with that crew, going through the script with them and really getting it to a place where they felt, okay, yeah, we're proud to shoot this. It was a really cool experience.
You recently said that this new season was mostly about a crisis of faith. Well, what did you mean by that?
I think, you know, for the Rami character, we kind of built the show. The premise of the show was always, what does it look like for someone to not try to erase not just lineage, but their faith practice? Because I think what I was seeing a lot of was this attitude of, oh, I grew up religious, I grew up this way, but thank God now I'm free of that and I get to update. And I said, well, that's not really how I feel. You know, there's a lot of my tradition, a lot of my faith that I want to adhere to, but I'm kind of trying to figure out what it means to do that right now in this current moment in time. And I thought that tension was different. You know, the guy actually wants his faith. This season is the first time in the show where he's disillusioned by it. And we're kind of watching him, I think, arc from performing faith to kind of stripping it down and putting it back together again. You know, that's the journey that I wanted to put him through this season.
There's also in this season more of an emphasis on the crisis of faith in the American dream when it comes to your parents,
yeah,
in particular. Was that on mind?
Very, very. I mean, I think it was also looking at, you know, we're coming out of COVID and we're coming out of a big reimagining and also a big dent to a lot of the systems that, you know, we've all been trying to invest in, you know, to work. And then we kind of watched a lot of them really shake. And that's still playing out now. You know, the rebounds of that are really happening today. And I think part of the pressure that a Rami type has or any kid of an immigrant has is knowing that their parents made a really tough move. That was a gamble. And, you know, you're the dice. And you got to roll the right way in order for them to feel good about what they did. And so when you spend a lot of your life feeling like I got to be the thing that makes my parents' existence worth it, it's a very odd pressure to have. But then, you know, really also wanting to step back from the parents who are like, whoa, was it really worth it for us to even come here and make this gamble too? You know, are we getting what we thought we would get? Is this the dream we signed up for? A lot of these things that they put a lot of stock in are falling apart for them. And I think that's also part of them realizing, oh, okay, you know, we've been living culturally in a certain way, but we need to be more spiritual because we're trying to invest in land. We're trying to invest in the idea of a country. We're trying to invest in this idea of a job and what a job means and to have a job that informs my identity. And then realizing, no, there's probably something more spiritual to really be digging into. And so, yeah, that awakening is happening for all the characters.
To understand the context of the dream, your parents had, I think we have to go back a little bit because you grew up in New Jersey with Egyptian parents. And you said as practicing Muslims, there was a performative element that felt like you were living in your own Truman Show. We've been talking a whole lot about performance. What did that look like?
I'm trying to remember the context in which I said that. That does sound like something I said. You're pulling great stuff.
I like that you like your words.
I'm like, dude, past me was...
Wow.
You ever worry that you're regressing?
Yeah, I do.
Is that regress easy?
We do 52 a year, so I have a shot at redemption every week.
This one's a progress episode.
We're finding it.
I feel it.
Yeah.
Your progress is in how I answer these questions.
And your progress?
This podcast bears nothing on my progress.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've already had a good time like coming in.
Oh, okay.
This is in the win column. Yeah, yeah, I'm already having a good time.
Mostly to do with the Pop-Tarts.
Then. The Pop-Tarts. I like the lighting in here.
It's nice.
You're nice. The AC is good. I'm good.
Yeah.
I won.
Sounds like Trump.
Honestly, if you didn't look at what he did and just, you know, some of what he said, an optimist.
I mean, I could see how someone who grew up with a photo of Donald Trump in their living room, as you did, would say something like that. You want to offer context for that for people?
My father, yeah, he worked at the Plaza Hotel for over 10 years. When he came to the country, he just started, you know, he was a busboy he started at the Waldorf Astoria. And it was because he spoke Arabic and there were a lot of high-spending Arab clientele that would come in from the Gulf.
He was previously a travel agent in Cairo.
Yeah. I forgot you know my dad.
I mean, he was last week's guest, so.
But yeah, so he started busing, and then he kind of went over to the plaza, and he was doing that too, and then eventually became a manager of all the food and beverage and all their like banquet halls and all that stuff. And so he'd do the Trump kids' birthdays or something. He's like, oh, I'm working late tonight. It's, you know, Eric's birthday, you know, like that, you know. And at the time wasn't bad or anything. It was just, this is just, you know, a guy my dad works with. But I think part of what we got to explore in the first season, which was something that was very true to my life, just that fear of being a kid and being so close. And at the time my dad worked in the city when 9/11 happened. And I think part of what we got to do as a show and part of what even other things that I continue to explore is just the impact of that time for the psyche of a kid, especially a kid who felt implicated.
Is that how you felt?
Yeah, I did, because you're looking at a screen on TV and you're seeing these people who've done horrible things, and you know, one of them's Egyptian, the other one's this, the other one's that, and they have names that sound like people in my family, and some look like people that are in my family, you know. So, and that's the only reference point in any media was that, right? And then you start to have this self-doubt trickle in where I always felt like I had something to hide, even though there wasn't anything to hide. Mm. And then I also didn't get to fully digest my own background from, you know, like a pure context or even an inquisitive, curious context. It's all in the defensive, you know? So everything that I know is just about defending myself at that time. It's not a curious exploration and an understanding. And I see this in a lot of people of my generation where it's like now we're in our 30s and only just now we're really getting into our faith and our background from like a more curious place.
Specifically, do you remember a moment where you can kind of acutely remember playing defense as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is in the episode we made in the show of just like, I remember really being in a history class as a middle schooler and pointing to a map and really trying to put Egypt in Africa, you know, and just say wholeheartedly, straight-faced, saying I'm African, you know, like, and then leaving and knowing I'm not really African. I know I'm not African, you know, and being in that place. But for me, the whole thing is I'm never going to be someone who sits and pretends like horrible things happened to me, you know, or we experienced hate crimes on a big level or something like that. And it's why in making the show, I never try to paint the family or the Rami character as victims, because I'm not in a position to say I'm a victim, but I am in a place to say, oh, you know, there are things that really happened here that, oh, maybe I can make an offering to unpack comedically, but it was a mind fuck the whole time. It took me a long time to even admit that.
So if it was difficult to explore or even examine parts of yourself at home, I wonder when high school rolls around, you take this TV production class. Was making videos in that class a way of examining and exploring parts of yourself that you previously weren't able to do?
You know, I felt this when I was a kid, even before I went to high school. The first thing I ever saved up for with my Eid, post-Ramadan Eid money, was a video camera. And I loved that. I remember being a kid and just going around the whole town and my street, and I would film things, and then we'd go visit my grandparents in Queens, and they had a computer that had a Windows Movie Maker. It'd be a whole day. We'd be there a whole weekend. And I would just be in there on that computer editing things that I shot. And then by the time I got to high school, there were more tools to do that. Then that became short films and that kind of thing. And then I started to write. I was writing those, and then I started to be in them. And so it was a big incubator, and my buddy Jonathan Braylock, who I still work with a lot, but then my buddy Steve Way, who's on our show, we did a lot together in that period, and I think we kind of started to find a lot of things that we were just making each other laugh, and then years later, we got to make the show together.
Well, we are going to watch one of those films that appeared on a YouTube comedy channel called Inside Joke Films. Now, for the context around this period, you're a freshman in college at Rutgers, 19 years old, working part-time at an Apple store in the meatpacking district.
Yes.
Attending acting classes at William Esper Studio. Once those classes ended, you would run to the train station, hop on, get home by 12:30, 1 o'clock, and fall asleep. That process was like wash, rinse, and repeat.
Yes.
And it's in that wash, rinse process that you wake up one morning, brush your teeth, and notice a minty saliva dribble running down your chin, which I think happened to me this morning, by the way. But what happened there?
I got Bell's palsy. The level of research is unbelievable. I'm starting to think you knew to bring these mini Pop-Tarts just based on something I had said at some point. Yeah, that was a big life changer for me because I was doing everything, you know, and I was going to college in the morning, then I'd go work at the Apple Store, and then I'd go to acting class, and then I'd do an improv set at night or a sketch or whatever, and then I'd get home really late. I was truly burning myself out at a pretty young age. Then this thing stopped me, and I said, okay, you know, I can't move my face. It's weird. Sometimes it goes away after a few days. They'll go, oh, it'll be a few days, or it'll be a few weeks, or it'll be a few months, or it'll be a year. And if it's more than a year, it just might be how your face is, where half your face just doesn't work. You can't even blink. I had to wear an eye patch at night because my eye would otherwise dry out. And I had it for 6 months. This was like my biggest, at the time, bargain with God, which was, okay, if this gets better, I'm going to drop out of school. All I'm going to do is I'm going to work on acting. If it doesn't get better, I will accept it and I will continue school and I'll drop out of acting school and I'm just become a lawyer. You know, so I was really dramatic about it. And it made it a real inflection point for me to say, okay, if I heal from this, I'm actually going to free myself from trying to do everything and trying to please everybody. And I was in that place where I was enjoying performing, but I really wanted, you know, to do right by, again, you know, my parents made this gamble. I didn't know anyone who succeeded in comedy. You know, how do I go home and tell my dad, like, thank you for not seeing your parents for a majority of your life, and I'm going to perform at a theater. But then this thing happened, and I said, life's too short. I got to just do this for me. So it created that.
Well, why don't we take a look at you in that fork in the road moment where you turned Bell's Palsy into a short film aptly titled Bell's Palsy.
Hilarious.
Robbie, we got it to Chicago Sketch Fest.
Yes.
No, no.
What?
What's wrong with your face?
John, I told you on the phone. I have Bell's palsy.
We gotta come up with a plan.
No, there's no plan. We just need to...
I got it!
This is great, man. You can't even tell. But, you know Halloween's over tonight, right? It's okay, man. I've got a plan.
Really?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, Happy New Year!
Oh, come on!
What?
You still have Bell's palsy?
John, I told you that the changing of the year wouldn't magically heal it.
That was my Christmas resolution.
That's sweet.
I know.
I have not watched that for 10 years.
How does that feel, watching that a decade later?
It's cool that we did it.
It's not that bad. I was like, this should be a lot worse.
Right? I watched one of the sketches we did. I was getting ready to be like, this is going to really suck. And then I went back and I was like, it doesn't really suck. I mean, yeah.
No, they're all tightly edited.
It actually means a lot because that's when you work with a network. They always edit you down, you know? But we had no network, man. We edited ourselves down.
I'm not here to cut you down.
I take pride in that. You know, I'm like, wow, we had that down. You know, maybe the writing wasn't always there. Maybe we were figuring out our voice. But we edited.
Your commitment to editing, to acting, to making these, it is what propelled you forward and brought you to Los Angeles. Did you make that call to come here at like 3 a.m. at a place called the Candlewick Diner? Because it seems like you love making big decisions in diners. And I love diners. I think you love them more than me and Michael Mann, who I thought loved them the most, based on every film he's made.
I love diners. Sometimes I feel like my whole life's happened in a diner.
What happens to you in there? Is it just like the prices? Is it the good attitude?
In a Jersey diner, they are encouraging you to loiter. And I think that was really nice to have. I definitely edited some of those sketches. I would go plug in at a diner for sure.
Did you make your decision to come to LA at one of those?
It was kind of made for me because I booked this, you know, show on Nick at Night. And I actually was reminiscing about this the other day because it was funny. I got, you know, a call from my manager at the time and he said, listen, if you can fly yourself out to LA, they want you to meet, do this producer session, right? For anyone who doesn't know, it's like you meet producers, and then if producers like you, you test with the network. And if you test with the network, they pay for your flight. But the producer session, you don't get that. And so I remember looking at my bank account. I got this call. I was at Apple. I had just dropped out of school. I looked up ticket prices. I looked at how much money I had. I logged into my like Wachovia bank app at the time. Then Wachovia famously got acquired by Wells Fargo. So this is just for anyone who's like really into the economy.
That's most of our listeners.
I think a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
So Wachovia. So I go to my Wachovia. I type in my username, my password. I look at the amount of money.
Sounds like a virus.
It honestly really does have like coronavirus.
Last night, I picked up Wachovia.
I picked... Of course we are. She didn't tell me.
Oh, you're the editor? It's great.
Oh, this is staying in.
Well, you do like editing.
I love editing. And I'm telling you, the Wachovia bit has to stay in. I log into my Wachovia. I look at how much money I have. I look how much the plane ticket is. The disparity between what it will cost to get me there and what I have is...
Under $50?
It's under $300. It's okay. Tight. But at the time, $300, you're eating, for a couple of days. But at the time, I go, okay, I'm going to do this. My goal was not to get the show. It was to test. Because I thought if I can test for the network, at least I know they'll get me a hotel and they'll get me the flight back. I couldn't fathom that I'd actually book it because it just felt so insane. But yeah, so I end up going and I test and I was like, great. They got my flight back. They put me in a hotel. I literally go from my friend Lena's couch to getting a hotel over on like Hollywood and Vine. I'm like, this is big. I'm by the Chinese Theater. I'm hanging out. I'm going to the Wax Museum. I'm living life. And then I booked the role, and
we're like a couple blocks from there.
Dude, every time I drive by, and I lived here for 10 years, every time I drive by, I go, man, remember that trip? Because it's a big shift, it's across the country, which is almost like going to a different country. And I was living at home, and then suddenly I'm living by myself. It's actually still the biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life.
After the break, more from Rami Youssef.
I've interviewed many successful people over the years, and one thing I find fascinating is many of them don't consider themselves business savvy. Take the owners of Tight Knit Brewing. They turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards, and do all of it in one place with the Chase mobile app. And that's helped these brew-loving friends turn a passion into a business. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is Accelerating Innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, musora.com, to start a new musical journey today.
So you move here for this show called See Dad Run.
Yeah.
You're living in an apartment in Koreatown on 6th and St. Andrew Place.
Yes.
When you get this show,
yeah,
I was thinking, because, like, you know, this writer's strike is upon us right now.
Yeah.
Will you be able to stay afloat through See Dad Run residuals?
That's the question. Whatever deal we made on that was part of an issue that the WGA had, because it was like such a bad type of deal. It was a residualless deal, actually. And it's the kind of thing that they're trying to get to the bottom of. So I would say the lineage of See Dad Run is very directly tied to what the Guild is fighting for now, you know, over 10 years later. And so you could see that run to the current strike that is upon us. So that's a really clear line that not a lot of people are drawing. I think if you had a yarn board, it's a big one.
And it's like, it's kind of good that we're finally drawing it, that we're finally making the connection. That's always been there.
It's always been there. It's been unsaid. It's been awkward. It's been kind of one of those Hollywood things no one wants to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Should we?
And we've dared to.
Wow. You know, this is See Sam Run. You know, this is big. I stand by that joke.
And that's
keep
our
it
show.
In the cut.
Really, that's
keep
it.
Keep it in the cut. I stand by it. It is. It's not quite Wachovia level, but it's good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel sick after it, unlike Wachovia. One of your co-stars on See Dad Run is an Oakland comedian named Mark Curry.
Yes.
He decides to take you on the road where you open for him. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, there's one night in particular. You're at a hotel and you're by yourself in your room. And it sounds like, I think because you just bombed, that you kind of lean into and start to discover your comedic voice as a stand-up. Is that right?
I bombed so bad that the Miami Improv booked another comedian for the next night because I did so poorly the night before. You know, I was supposed to do 15 minutes and then I did it. But then the next night they said, hey, you only need to do 5 tonight. You know, we got someone else to do. In between the nights, I had this thing. I didn't know anyone in the city. I was so embarrassed. I was so ashamed. And then I go into the hotel and I completely just force myself to say, okay, I don't want to feel that again. And I wrote a lot that night. And then the next night I came in, and even though they had cut my time, like my 5 was really on it. But I remember the club owner really being like, where was that last night? And I just said jet lag. And then I walked away kind of confidently.
It sounds like you made a kind of pivot in the work. What do you think you were moving towards?
It was just digging deeper. It was playing a different kind of room. You know, I started doing stand-up when I moved to LA. You know, I'm doing like Silver Lake Rooms, Burbank, these kind of different kind of demographics, as opposed to when you go to a Mark Curry show and it's like, I could feel this thing of what's your essence, as opposed to some of these smaller rooms I was starting to do stand-up in. It was just, do you have a witty idea? These rooms, they were like, dude, are you funny or are you not funny? Because if you're not funny, we'll just talk until Mark comes out. It wouldn't even be like I bombed and it was silent. They would just watch me for 2 minutes and then go, anyway, so, and then just conversations start. Full conversations are happening while you're doing stand-up. And so immediately I had to put myself in a position of how do you hold attention, and also realizing the value of having people's attention. Don't waste it. Really offer them something. So I just dug much deeper and I had to move through a lot of fear. And it was really nice to not be in a city where I knew anyone. Those early road dates were just really good for that. You know, you don't know anyone. So just go to the hotel room and write and get better.
But it essentially all came back to essence.
Yeah. Any useful diversion from someone's attention to say, watch this, listen to this, do whatever, I take very seriously. And I say, well, I better be providing a unique essence of something for them if I'm gonna ask them to take an hour to watch my special, 30 minutes to watch an episode. Like, why? Why am I asking you to not talk to your family for 30 minutes? This better be worth it.
Well, then I think we should probably take a look at what may be the earliest televised example of you stepping into and finding your essence, which comes in 2017, when you made your late night debut on The Colbert Show.
Yeah.
The performance did come on the heels of Trump's Muslim ban.
I still think we're going to be okay. I really do. Because I believe in God. Like God. Not yoga. But. And I know that's a weird thing to say. I get it. You know, religious culture can be crazy. I don't agree with all of it. I grew up in a town where I watched my gay friends struggle to come out to the religious community. And now I live in LA, where I'm a religious person struggling to come out to the gay community and tell them what I think. And they're just like, you believe in God? Dude, that's so gay. I just, for me, God is hope that there's more to life than what's in front of us. You know, that even if things seem impossible, there's still a chance that it could be okay. And I'm not trying to be preachy. I'm really not. Like, all I'm trying to say is just submit to Islam because it's the truth. And that's the only way you'll be saved. Seriously, that's the only way.
That was 6 years ago now.
I feel like I'm so much younger there.
26?
Yeah. I still can't believe that they let me say that on TV too, because that was one where the producers were like, I remember just getting this call because they saw the transcript of the set and they're like, so yeah, so you're trying to say, you're trying to end the clip with submit to Islam. and I remember I had to like bring them out to a show to say, no, it's a bit, it ties to, you know, what's happening. And it's one of my favorite kind of bits because it's the kind of bit where if you are kind of just an open-minded, I'll say, comedy fan that skews liberal on a certain level, you watch that and you go, oh, that's really funny. Like, he's playing on this fear that everyone has. If you're conservative, you're like, oh my God, look at this. It's the Muslim agenda. And if you're Muslim, you're like, nice. It's the Muslim agenda. You know, so it kind of hits all three buckets, which is what I, you know, is kind of my favorite, you know, lane to be in.
You're always thinking about those three buckets?
Yeah. I want them all to be happy, which sounds like an insane way to live.
It does.
Sometimes I feel, you know.
Insane.
Insane. And I know you feel it too.
Don't drag me into this.
Of yourself. Dude, come on. You do.
Well, you had me at Wachovia.
This is such a good bit. That bit comes from pain and shame.
Yeah.
You know.
I like that you know. That's good.
I know, dude.
You can hear it in my voice.
Yes, man. Stuff people can't even see on the podcast. It's a body language thing. Oh, wow. Seeing that's crazy. I haven't watched that.
And looking back at that clip, it feels like a clear bridge between your early comedy and the comedy that would inform the pilot of Rami.
Yeah, I did that Nick show, and then I was doing The Road with Mark, and I remember that show ending and thinking, okay, cool, I was on a show, and now that I've been on a show, I'm going to be on other shows, I'm going to act. And it never happened. I was so bad at auditioning, or I would get really anxious, but then I would also feel like nothing quite fit me. You know, I would go in, and they'd be like, you're not the leading guy. You're not exactly the nerd. Well, we want you to play the brown guy, but they didn't understand the reference in which they were writing it. They would write something that was for someone who was Indian or Pakistani, and then they'd say, oh, you're kind of, you know, there was no real. So there was this thing where the acting thing just wasn't hitting. And I almost forgot for a period that I knew how to make my own things because I just got so into the acting world. And then I said, hold up, I got, you know, this gift of an acting job, but that's over. And now I got to go back to digging into what it is I really want to say and what I want to do. And so there was this period of just doing stand-up for the first time in a serious way. It was like 3 years straight where it's just I'm doing stand-up every night. I'm figuring out what the next chapter of my life is going to be. My first ever open mic in LA was with my buddy Ari Kacher. He'd been working on Gerard Carmichael's show, and I had been opening for Gerard. I'd also been opening for Mo, who, you know, we made, you know, his show together now. And so in that time, I was just doing a bunch of sets with them. But then Ari and I kind of started talking about, okay, cool, like, let's do the show. It was a really productive time.
From there, you make the show. It premieres in 2019. You win a Golden Globe in 2020. But throughout the show's run, it's been 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of people have compared Rami to programs like Louie, Master of None, Fleabag. But I want to talk about the influence of Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Because you said once, there's a twinship between Jewish humor and Muslim humor. What is that?
It's like an inherent sarcasm, an inherent self-deprecation. You know, it really hit me just how not celebrating Christmas really put me so closely intertwined with my Jewish friends. It's you're really missing out on this massive human event. You feel like a 5-year-old adult because everyone believes in magic And you're like, dude, this is just a ploy for Macy's to sell stuff in December. You know, and you're looking at your Jewish friends and they're the only other ones who know. And so there's something about that in America where I feel, oh man, we're the only ones who really get each other here because we missed out this childhood window of daydreaming about Santa. We're like, yeah, that dude wouldn't fit down the chimney. And you got a bunch of kids who are like, of course he fits because of the, you know what? And you're just like, you guys are brainwashed. It creates something very early on that I've found to be at the heart of our humor. You know, I mean, yeah, look, Larry's just, I think, the funniest. And he's so honest to what he thinks and his perspective. And it's why I always think Muslims and Arabs are some of the funniest people because they're so steadfast, whether in what they believe or what they think, they're not going to move off it. Mm. And that's comedy to me. And when you have four people in a room who all think that way, it's just so much certainty. It's just hilarious. It's just so funny. I feel that's what's really funny about Larry. He's so certain, despite being completely wrong.
That, and so is Rami in a whole lot of situations. Like thinking back to that scene we started with at the beginning of this conversation, you're on a Tinder-like date, but he's certain that he's the best she can do under these
under conditions. Under the occupation.
Yeah.
That is definitely something that is his own kind of probably Larry David-ish moment.
It is reminiscent of Curb Your Enthusiasm because there are so many moments in that show, like in Rami, where you're sitting there going, oh my God.
Dude, what are you?
Will he just stop talking? Okay, but hold on. We're talking about the comedy side of this show.
Yeah.
But so much of the writing and the dialogue around Rami is about representation, what this show means in this moment and what it tells us about X people, mm-hmm. which I've always found to be sort of reductive and not terribly interesting.
Yep.
So I want to ask about something more specific, which is this quote you have. You said, my work is not about showing that we're all the same. It's actually about highlighting the differences because we're not all the same, but we're all trying in a similar way and we're all feeling in a similar way regardless of those differences.
Yeah, I stand by it even more so because I think the level of specificity that we aim for is not with the intention of creating a flag to represent. It's just the thing that me and the people who make the show want to do with this specific set of characters. And it's not really meant to be wholly representative of almost anyone, even if you get really subsecty, you know what I mean? I've always felt like the show has a right to exist outside of that framing because then it allows it to be something that is an exploration in its own tone and its own thing and not have to fit into, hey, Muslims, we've got a show for you. Because that puts us in an impossible position that is also an inaccurate one. And so, yeah, I'm not interested in saying we're all the same. Like, I'm more in favor of saying, no, no, we're different, but we have the same debts. We have the same stresses. We have the same desires, even though the way we approach them or the tools we have or the belief systems we have look different, you know? And so it's like, yes, on a level here, I'm saying something has been done to say that people who live in the Middle East are not human, you know? So on a level, that has been done through a lot of the media that's happened over the last 30 years. There's been a dehumanization. So in terms of where Rami falls into the realm of representation, it probably mainly checks the box of, if you thought we weren't human beings, we are. But if I'm trying to tell you anything other than that, it's going to fall short. I'm not trying to say this is what Muslims are like all over. I'm not trying to say that I'm just like you. I'm not trying to say whatever, but I'm trying to say the process of surviving and the process of living and being, all of that is really similar. And so the monoculture of just us, we're all the same. It's well-intentioned, but it really falls short. And then sometimes the goal of what that does, that's where I see the effects of colonialism still happening. And in, you know, there's countries in the Middle East where, you know, you'll go into a restaurant and they only have a menu in English. If you don't read English, don't even be here. These are the kinds of things we've been kind of led to believe in our own culture because the storytelling and the narrative of what American culture is so strong. And I'm not saying it's all bad. I mean, I love that I grew up here. And part of loving growing up here is getting to talk about all the baggage that comes with that and how that influences everyone everywhere. And what's fun about making these shows and you know, now we're making more shows and we're doing other things that I've been able to do with my production company as it's grown out of making Rami and making other things is like, we just get to show so many different slices of that. And I think representation is not one show. It's like 30, you know, it's movies. It's a lot of artists getting to try and getting to fail and getting to mess up and getting to be imperfect and getting to succeed. That is more so what I think that means as opposed to, you know, anything one season of television or even three could do.
That basically squares away the macro conversation. As we leave, I want to bring it back to you as a person.
Mm.
Because again, that episode that we've been interrogating and circling over and over again, episode 2, what happens in the last 10, 15 minutes involves you trying to get past the border, having your coat stolen. Inside the coat was your passport. These preteens took it, in part because you stole their bike. And you have this quote. You said, "I think what happens with this kid, the kid who stole your coat, boomerangs for Rami and becomes this ever-present haunting of what happened and is, for me, very symbolic of the manifestation of guilt that I just feel as a person all the time." I guess I want to sit with that because at 32,
yeah,
having just finished Ramadan and where you've been thinking about where you stand and where you are and where you want to go, that guilt that you feel, are you still working through that? Is that still fueling a lot of the work and who you are in this moment?
Yeah, it's just, I think about the cost of living all the time, just what it costs for us to have everything we want all the time, right? There are people in the margins of this country that are, you know, deeply suffering in ways that people in other parts of the world aren't. Then we've, you know, lived between New York and LA where you can walk into a supermarket and get whatever you want all the time. You walk into a clothing store and get whatever you want all the time. I'm willing to bet a lot of the people who listen to Talk Easy are able to afford some of those things. And that comes at a cost that's way beyond that. You know, when I look at the way the episode ends, haunts him the whole season because this character for sure is talking about his American passport and he's being very ignorant in how he's doing it. And then in order to fight for his privilege, someone in that episode directly suffers and they continue to. And he kind of goes off and he's trying to live his own life and he's spiraling in this way and then realizing, oh man, you know, and then it kind of comes to a moment at the end of the season where he tries to do something towards that debt, even if it's, you know, successful or not, isn't even the point, is he addresses it. And, you know, I think there were a lot of people who saw only that episode and didn't finish the season and were really upset by it. You know, they're really upset by what happened. I think part of that too, even going back to the representation conversation, when there's so little that even touches something like Palestine, I understand those sensitivities. And, you know, it's our stab, it's our try, and it's something that we made with like a Palestinian crew and Palestinian director who really, they understood the vision for the whole season because we're asking people to watch 10 episodes, not just the first two. We're asking people to be invested in what this means for a character. And so what it was trying to get at for me is that feeling of sometimes merely the way that you're living has a cost that you never have to look at. And if that is inspiring for me to like figure out anything I could do in my own, at times very minimal position in the scheme of the world, or if at any times I have windows or shots to talk about things in a bigger way, then I can't feel good about that because I need to continue to try and be at least somewhat part of making that a little bit better. And it's funny, you guys say it out loud and yeah, it sounds crazy or it sounds just incredibly, I don't know what it sounds like, but
it sounds like you listen to what your uncle told you as a kid. He said, it's the human's job to give back more than what they take.
That's one of his good quotes. That's a great quote. I think about that a lot.
It's funny, we keep circling around this idea of what it means to have a voice in this moment while not being overly delusional about its power. But I do want to know,
if you think your work, in some ways, is in line with the generations that came before you, because it seems to me that it feels like an amalgamation of the work your family has done, which includes your grandfather, who was an interpreter for the Arab League and the United Nations, then your father, as we mentioned, last week's guests, the travel agent in Cairo who would show Americans the pyramids. And so in thinking about being an actor, a writer, a director, the creator of this production company, Cairo Cowboy, do you feel like your work is a kind of amalgamation of both interpreter and travel guide?
Wow, that's beautiful.
The funniest answer would just be like, no.
You know, it's a soft no, but no, it's beautiful to hear it in that context. I think for me, I really respect people's time. You know, you only have a half an hour to watch them. You know, you have such a busy life. When you watch anything that I say, I'm not in a position to give you hard facts about anything. It's truly, it's just comedy, you know? But what I hope I'm able to do is just bring people closer to some of their own human questions. So a lot of what I'm doing and anything I'm doing is openly offering and workshopping the stuff that is going on in my head or in my heart or that I wonder about. I'm open to do that in as naked of a way as I know how to. And the hope is maybe that inspires a conversation you weren't going to have with someone in your family. And I think especially growing up in a few different communities, not even just, you know, the Arab or Muslim community, but a few different communities where it was hard to talk about certain vulnerable things. My hope is that, you know, me asking my questions, me doing my workshopping, me finding the funny patterns, and me also failing sometimes in how I do that, and other times succeeding in how I do that, is an offering that helps digest some things that are not digestible. Then I feel in my own little corner of what we're all kind of chipping in to try to do, I'm doing something, you know?
Well, then my last question here, if we ever like listen back to this or do this again.
Oh, I'll be back.
Okay. So when we do this again.
Yes.
Let's have this as a time capsule for us. At 32, recently married.
Yes.
What are those questions that you're asking yourself at this moment? We don't have to have the answers for them. What are those that you want to put on record?
Yeah, you know, that I want to put on record is just, we're really siloed right now. I think a lot of people are really siloed into their experience, into their phone, into the thing they're doing. What I've been thinking a lot about is, what is community going to look like? And how do we bring back being connected in as many real life ways as possible? And a lot of what I've been thinking about right now is, how do these stupid jokes and how do these shows, you know, where we're just giving, again, workshopping, giving our best stab and like trying to get at that, you know, ethereal it. What does that turn into just in terms of people getting to feel less lonely? But a lot of what I've been thinking about is just, yeah, well, what does that actually mean off screen? What does that actually mean beyond asking for people's attention? What happens once you have it? And where does that go? I don't think I'm the person to lead anyone once I have their attention, but it's more like, yeah, what does it look like to just turn that into a way where people just get to genuinely feel closer together in real life? And I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about, I'm sure you've been talking about in your circles a lot about AI and how what we're going to see over the next few years is just going to be so rapid. And I think that need for real life togetherness is going to be at an all-time high. Mm. And so I've just been trying to figure out, you know, what do I need on a personal level? But that's a big question.
You still want to make the show?
There's a lot I want to make. When we finished the first season, I realized what it took to make a season of television. And I remember thinking, I would love to do this for 3 or 4 seasons and then put it down for a bit and live some life. There's nothing about the story that says you can't take off for a while and then come back and say, you know, here's where this is at. So I think a lot of the decisions I'm making right now is, yeah, when does that hiatus come? Is it now or are we going to do one more? It's probably now.
Well, look, whenever you put it down, I'll make a promise that I'll still be here on the other side of it, if it's any consolation. And in terms of stupid jokes, boy, we have made so many of them. I don't know if they've helped make meaning out of this conversation. I hope.
But I think in the time here, we've definitely caught Wachovia.
God.
I think it's a great ending.
Rami Youssef, a pleasure.
So fun.
Buddy, that was great.
Wow.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us a review on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. Just clicking those 5 stars, somehow, even in 2023, is still the best way for new listeners to find the show. I want to give a special thanks this week to Chase Lehner, Matt Haberman, and the team at Narrative PR, Hulu, and of course, Rami Youssef. All 3 seasons of Rami are available to stream exclusively on Hulu. If you haven't watched the show already, I highly recommend you do so. If you'd like to learn more about Rami and his work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more conversations, I'd recommend our talks with Bob Odenkirk, Quinta Brunson, Hiro Murai, Abby Jacobson, Natasha Lyonne, Padma Lakshmi, Alan Ruck, and Bill Hader. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to support Talk Easy by purchasing one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with writer Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. That's TalkEasyPod.com/shop. As always, Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editors are Clarice Guevara and CJ Mitchell. Music by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Chris Shenoy. Photographs today are by Julius Chu. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. Special thanks to Kaylin Ung. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries. Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Navarez, Tara Machado, Maya Koenig, Carly Migliore, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I hope you enjoyed our midweek episode with Arlo Parks. If you haven't checked that out yet, I'd recommend you do so. She's a fantastic young Gen Z musician. I have never felt older just saying that sentence. Anyway, I'll be back next Sunday with actor Oscar Isaac. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.